I'm David Solomonoff, president of the Internet Society of New York. We're here at the Freedom Box Hackfest at Columbia University, and we have Isaac and
Marcus
from the Free Network Foundation.
That's right.
And that their project is complementary to the Freedom Box, which is a small, inexpensive computer which provides encrypted, decentralized and encrypted secure communications for end users, and the Free Network Foundation is seeking to build a more secure and private internet infrastructure using mesh networking. And do you want to tell us a little bit how that works and where you are with the project?
Sure. So mesh networking, as well as community wireless in general, and all forms of community broadband and horizontal networks, we're specifically focused at the moment on access networks. So we're building tools that will help people build cooperative internet service providers and autonomous systems. Right now we've developed prototypes of the first two of our tools. We call them Freedom Link and Freedom Tower. Freedom Link is basically a BGP speaker for this regional cooperative autonomous system.
Tell us what BGP is.
Oh, sorry. BGP is a border gateway
protocol.
So that's where autonomous systems communicate routes to one another at the core of the internet. Right. You have these autonomous systems talking to one another, and BGP is the protocol that they use to communicate which addresses are available in their system.
Right. So that's a protocol that the switches and routers typically for an ISP's network would use to communicate to connect to the internet backbone and other network providers. That's not something that an end user normally deals with directly. It's another protocol for the actual core services of the internet.
Exactly. So we're trying to democratize that a little bit, not maybe for end users, but for a wider swath of the population who could act as network operators on behalf of their friends and family.
Yeah, community network representatives or conduits.
Okay, so the next thing that you're working on.
So the next
component.
The next tool that we've developed is called the Freedom Tower. And it is it consists of a couple of nettop computers, one of which acts as a router and one of which acts as a server, and a collection of basically Wi-Fi radios, microwave communications gear that allow it to establish pretty good links to other devices of a similar nature. So there are a variety of frequencies that can be used, but we imagine that any given region, so for example, Detroit, we're planning to this spring and this summer build out our first sort of model network of what we'd like to see networks look like. We're planning to build out in Detroit, so I'll use that as an example. We would have one Freedom Link, perhaps connected to a gigabit fiber pipe, and from there we would start shooting 3650 megahertz, which is a semi-licensed band, out to these towers.
What does semi-licensed mean?
So, in the 3650 megahertz band, one organization applies for a license from the FCC. I think it's a $200 or $250 license, and that grants you a nationwide license for as many base stations as you want to have. So it's not like the other licensed bands where you get a base station license for the actual geographical coordinates. And it's basically more flexible, it's more open, so there's slightly more interference because other people can use the band. It's not like you have an exclusive license, but it is sort of licensed, so it's a much cleaner band than either the 2.4 gigahertz ISM, which is BG Wi-Fi, or the 5.7 gigahertz, which is AN Wi-Fi. And it's in between those two and much cleaner. And they make equipment for carriers to use it. So we would use that. But that's kind of a tangent.
I mean, But it's an important tangent because it sort of expresses where we are right now.
Sure.
Like, our colo is in Kansas City. Our test deployment's in Brooklyn. We're going to be in Detroit mm-hmm. permanently. We have to use a nationwide licensing mm-hmm. ban because if we were to go in any of the other routes, we'd have to change it. It'd be a lot of...
So that simplifies the configuration of all your hardware.
Yeah.
Right. So the tower has in it, as I mentioned, a router and a server. So that enables it to do some pretty cool things that the radio equipment on its own couldn't do. So the router runs pfSense, which is a pretty well-known
firewall routing,
and VPN termination. Mm-hmm. Piece of software. So, and we use it to do all of those things. So one thing that's nice about that is a network built with this stack can have security really baked in because, and that's one of the weaknesses of community wireless is, okay, you're sending it over free space. It becomes vulnerable. Well, you can even have an unencrypted network as long as everything's inside of a VPN tunnel. It actually does provide verifiable
it's
security.
At that point.
Exactly. So it's encrypted at the endpoints before it even goes over the link.
Right.
So then the third piece of hardware, which we haven't built yet and which we're now really starting to think about concretely, and this is the one that directly interfaces with the Freedom Box, is one that we call Freedom Node. And what that would be is at least as we imagine it at this stage, and this is subject to change, would be a USB peripheral for the Freedom Box or the XO, whatever computer. That would be a plug-and-play network interface. So as soon as you plugged it into the computer would recognize it as a network interface, and it would consist basically of a system... An integrated board for some routing tasks and two radios. So those radios could be modular. They would probably be 5 gigahertz. And what that basically would allow for is Freedom Boxes could participate in a free network, in a mesh. The information stored on the Freedom Box, because the Freedom Box has the potential to shift the paradigm so that data, rather than being stored in the cloud, is stored locally. But
it's like a private cloud, basically.
Yeah, it is.
Right. Go on.
Like, imagine a neighborhood FTP server mm-hmm. where everyone could load up all their favorite, you know, music, and you could access your building mate's music, mm-hmm. and not necessarily all the music in the world, but all the cumulative music held by the people part of the cloud. Mm-hmm. But it's more secure because file transfers between the people aren't subject to packet inspections. They don't have to go all the way up.
Right. You could also build different kinds of redundancy pretty easily, right?
Where, yeah.
Things are duplicated across Freedom Boxes, basically.
Exactly,
and you'd have a failover there if somebody's hard disk died or something of that sort, or they went offline temporarily.
Yeah, so distributed storage. So the idea is that if a Freedom Box were attached to a Freedom Node, and the Freedom Node were up in the window talking to other Freedom Nodes in the neighborhood, and those all were talking to the tower, which is talking to other towers in the region, which is talking to the link, which is connected to other autonomous systems in the internet, you would have access to the global internet, no doubt. But you would be able to share locally and within your own autonomous system, that being, you know, the free network Detroit, whatever, mm-hmm. Just an example, you would be able to share within that system without ever having to go transit across an upstream provider, which is really where people get the opportunity to inspect packets, as long as our internal policies are not to log and not to
right.
do that type
That's
of thing.
Where I was going to come in. Now, legally, with things like CALEA, if I start an internet I become an ISP, I start my own ISP tomorrow. Mm-hmm. There, I'm legally required to give the capability of eavesdropping and the switches and routers on my network to the government. Mm-hmm. That is a requirement. Now, how you are eventually going to be functioning as a ISP, you're going to be purchasing upstream mm-hmm. internet connectivity and mm-hmm. then connecting it to your network and making it available. How do you beat that? Basically, how do you make your internet service basically, resistant to?
With good lawyers, I think. I mean, that's the first.
That's an answer.
It's an important answer, though.
I was asking the question more in a technical sense.
So I think Marcus does have a great point here, which is we should be struggling to make sure that our laws are just and ethical as regards data retention and
sure.
accessibility to the security apparatus. But on a technological level, there are, I won't call them countermeasures, but there are practices, which I would consider best practices, which mitigate some of that. So when for instance, it's not illegal for people, for at least an ISP doesn't have any legal liability if two of its customers are connected directly to one another and exchange traffic. The ISP isn't, as long as they're not using
the internet.
Right.
The internet, as long as that information isn't transiting the internet work, then the ISP doesn't have legal liability. Moreover, if traffic going out to the global internet is in cipher, if
there was, before it hits the
before it ever hits the backbone, if the ISP can say to whoever comes calling, I would love to give you access, but unfortunately all of that information is encrypted by nature of the system. And this is where it comes back to
the
legal.
Are physically in somebody's domicile.
Right. They only the user can access that information.
Right.
So then there is still a legal avenue for the government to get access to the information,
right.
And that is get a warrant or get a subpoena, go into the person's home, take their private key, decrypt their freedom box,
right.
And you can have access to it as it was intended to be,
right.
As it was intended to be. So, I think. And it does come back to the legal remedies, right? Because that position exists in something of a legal gray area.
I
think that the law is on our side there, but it's certainly, I think, when put into practice, would be a matter of litigation, potentially.
Yeah. Well, you characterize us as an ISP, which is correct. We'd be more like a WISP, kind of like, isn't that what you do?
Okay.
So, the difference, like the salient aspect of this scenario seems to be that there literally is no centralized, like, information holder, or like there is no place where this information would even be tangible. Like, for the government to come to us, to approach us and request the information would do them no good. And I think that in the courts, we have a much greater chance for success if you have to ask the owner of the information for their information,
mm-hmm.
which would be very,
right.
That'd be
right.
Very different from
right.
the
it's different when
precedents.
Twitter may get some bad PR, but their business model and their the interests of the company and the stockholders and what have you are, the owners of of the company, they have no real stake in your
right.
Physical
yeah.
well-being
exactly.
or privacy or anything else.
Precisely.
you're basically providing a product that they can sell, and that's really what they care about.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, what's happening here, as I understand it, and tell me if I'm getting your model right, it's basically you're building much more of a private network, and we're now. For me to send let's say an email to somebody who's my next door neighbor, they're right behind the wall. My email goes at least to my internet provider, to their internal network and quite likely onto the internet to come back to go behind that
exactly.
wall. So in your model, much more of this would be not the internet, but a private network. And there are a lot of ways that that's just better in terms of network design, a lot faster and, you know, lower overhead. But basically I would be going, you know, from my, you know, Wi-Fi router on one side of the wall to her
exactly.
router more
it'll
or less directly or through
your freedom box to your freedom node to her freedom node to her freedom box.
Sure, right.
So
exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, like this.
That
is,
legally is very different. Right.
Thinking like I mean, I've had an interest in law for a long time, like before I went to college and things, and so this question has been something I've been thinking about for a long time, something that I've been expecting. And I think that, well, Detroit was a great place for us to start because my mother works in, she's an official in the fire department. And I thought that the communications between the fire department internally and with the police department and the police department internally and with other government services is considerably more local than, like, if someone from the fire department sends an email to someone, it's not generally going to Chicago or New York. It's probably going to another Detroit firefighter. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that, like, we present this avenue, like, this means of communication to the fire department and the police department directly in a place where they are struggling for funds. Mm-hmm. They can barely keep their departments open because right. of the budget cuts and tax revenue leaving and a host of issues. But I thought that they would see the Free Network Foundation's model as most applicable to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so they would destroy, I mean, I find it hard to believe that a government entity that we would serve and prove would harm us, or, you know, would prosecute us or seek us out. But, I mean,
they're looking to build a synergistic relationship.
Exactly, right? Exactly.
So one of the big open questions, which this brings to light, is the locality of exchange in general on the internet. We don't know with any real certitude, any scientific certitude, how localized communication on the internet is. So what I mean to say is, do people mostly talk to their neighbors? Or do people mostly use the internet to talk to people that are very far away? And I think the people that would be best in the position to answer that question are Facebook. They are not prone to release that data. We contemplated briefly posing as marketers that wanted market data.
Right?
Yeah, and see if we could get it that way, but we ended up just like kind of staying on the safe side. But that's the big question, because if it turns out, so Marcus presents this situation where we know that most communications are localized within a fire department, most of the emails getting sent, 95% of the emails getting sent, 97% of the emails getting sent are local, right? So that's something we're very interested in finding out about usage in general, is if do people mostly talk to their neighbors? Is it possible to keep most of this communication local, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Would there be a way, perhaps, this is about five steps ahead of where you are. But,
sure.
Let's say you have situations where there are communities that are very geographically, you know, far flung.
Sure.
Could you include in your system in the future something like a VLAN that would virtualize so all those people at great distances would, you know, virtually speaking, mm-hmm. you know, basically optimize the traffic in a way and kind of encapsulate it that way.
It requires a large capital investment, but I think
there would be probably a lot of people who would be interested.
We've got a ways to go. I mean, one of the things that we're interested in doing that we've played with doing is that the Freedom Link that I was talking about, the regional anchor, mm-hmm. would would act as a VPN terminus for outside hosts. So somebody plugs in a Freedom Box in Salina, Kansas, into an ADSL line, mm-hmm. And they're not participating in a cooperative network. They're buying their connectivity from a consumer ISP, just like everybody else. But they plug in their Freedom Box. Their Freedom Box tunnels into a free network, and they can participate in this in verifiably secure peer-to-peer exchange, and I think that that's something we've explored. There are also dangers there in centralization, where, you know, okay, so who's running the VPN terminus? Yeah. And obviously we're comfortable with that model because it's us and we trust ourselves, but
you're working a little bit more on authentication models that would be more secure.
Right. Ideally, any authentication and discovery model will be truly decentralized. Mm-hmm. So that's something we're still working on.
Mm-hmm. Are you using, I think you mentioned Namecoin earlier. Are you?
No. We're not using Namecoin, are we?
Well, no. It's something we've looked at. I think
just to
Nick
explain
mentioned
that
Namecoin.
Namecoin is sort of an alternative DNS system, mm-hmm. That would encompass the same, the existing domain name service database with additional entries for other kinds of domains and stuff. And it's a decentralized, highly secure model, and also it's the payment for the Namecoin domains that are unique to Namecoin are paid with in Bitcoins, the alternative digital
currency. Namecoin uses the same encryption technology as the Bitcoin. So I think the first step for us, if we were to use Namecoins, and we're just considering it, we haven't committed to any DNS protocol, have we? But or no. Paradigm. But
we're using DNSSEC.
I was just going to say
that we would review the instances in which Bitcoin was compromised, the security of Bitcoin mm-hmm. was yeah. compromised. I think there were two major ones. So look, we're starting from that and then moving forward.
The closest
evaluating Namecoin
that I think what seems most appealing to me at this point with as regards domain names is I would like to see us just, and I've talked to some of the folks involved in the OpenNIC project. And one thing that we could see is there's actually DNS itself, the protocol, at the protocol level, is a really decent domain name protocol, as, in my opinion, are most of the things that the IETF has put out have been really pretty solid work. The problem is not DNS, the protocol, mm-hmm. especially when you consider DNSSEC as an improvement to it. The problem is the root servers and who controls them, mm-hmm. which interfaces with the protocol, but isn't the protocol in itself.
No, that's a bureaucracy.
Right. Yeah, so yeah. What I would like to see us do is just stand up a root server for the OpenNIC infrastructure that has this whole alternative universe of namespaces and mm-hmm. top-level domains that already have users. I was talking to Paul Guerin from Wi-Fi NY.
Okay.
And I would like to see those namespaces be put back into use and have used the domain name system, but keep it open and it's an overused word, but democratize it and make mm-hmm. it so it's not so hierarchically controlled, which threatens bifurcation of namespaces. There are issues there, but I would rather see a bifurcated namespace than a namespace rigorously controlled by the mm-hmm. dominant existing power structure of our civilization.
Hosting our own root servers in the future.
Right. There are issues with that, and basically that's something where, you know...
Good question.
Sure, okay.
Are you thinking IPv4 or are you thinking IPv6?
V6 all the way. V6 all the way, especially... Well, I see your T-shirt for one thing, but especially V6 mobility. does tremendous things for us. It actually makes it possible. Because if a node moves from what we call a neighborhood network, what's attached to one tower to another, we need a way of efficiently...
prefixes.
Yeah, exactly. So V6 gives us so much more room to breathe, and we will certainly, you know, things are going to have to be dual stack for at least 5 years, I would say 10 maybe. And we'll have some outward facing V4 addresses, but ideally each node or each box will get its own V6 subnet.
Is V6 ready?
As far as I know, everything that's being built for Freedom Box is being built with V6 in mind. I think any really forward-looking internet working project at this point has to think V6, because between namespace depletion and just the sheer technological advancements that are contained in V6, it doesn't make sense to do it any other way.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add here or tell us about?
Well, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Can I ask you a question? I'm concerned about petty attacks on the network. Like simple, like someone going to their roof and starting a microwave. And I'm just throwing this question to everyone that I meet, because that's what Ars Technica said, that the Free Network Foundation was not feasible. It was unfeasible because...
Say it was unfeasible. It said it was quixotic.
Quixotic is what they said.
Oh, okay.
I mean, to use the same, quixotic more captures the meaning. But like this charge that someone could just put a microwave on full blast on their roof and interrupt the signal, jam the signal. And I mean, I guess we could hope to move. Like, I mean, our routing algorithm would reroute if there's a jam signal, but it doesn't seem very secure. I mean, what do you think?
Well, have you looked into, it still is a beyond the bleeding edge technology, but ultra wideband? Have you thought about that? The ability to really route in terms of the spectrum radically to different frequencies and get around it that way. Although you could have also a ultra wideband jamming. It's a cat and mouse game in the end.
I see us 10 years from now
is
ultra wideband cognitive mesh with, at that point we'll be 16 by 16 MIMO, beam forming, ideally.
And let's not forget using drones instead of towers.
Oh, well, exactly.
We're going to.
What I'd like
that's
to
our
see,
plan already.
Everybody
rotor drones. Though.
Everybody wants rotorcraft. I want dirigibles. I think dirigibles are beautiful and elegant.
Right.
Everybody else seems to want these rotorcraft, which I find terrifying.
also, that requires a lot more energy just to get...
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
So, I can see 10 years from now, lighter than air, maybe stabilized with propellers, but mostly just lighter than air flight with ultra wideband cognitive mesh technology that's everywhere from, the radio frequencies to optical. So I'd like to see free space optics come into use. I'd like to see, I'm excited about advances in antenna technology and radio technology.
There's also, what is that called, Li-Fi or with the lights, the ambient light?
I saw that. So there's a lot of cool communications tech that's coming out. I'm also really excited. A couple months ago, there was a splash that some, like Nick Farr from some people from the hackerspace scene and some people in European hackerspaces had started this hacker space program. And I was actually at Chaos Camp when they first announced it. But
it's to build a low orbital.
Right, so to launch these CubeSats, these little cheap CubeSats, constellation of CubeSats that would be geosynchronous, but they would form a constellation, and then the first step of the project is to build an open source ground station for satellites. So I would also love to see 10 years from now, the Freedom Links or the Freedom Towers would have integrated ground stations and would be able, at least for resilience's sake, to use that as a alternative backhaul to whatever
right.
fiber infrastructure we're using.
Right.
I would also like to see us build or lease our own fiber infrastructure from regional network to regional network, and that's when you get a truly global free network. Right. But that's right. way down.
Right. Well, actually, there's a company called Allied Fiber that's building a fiber. Their goal is coast to coast, and then from there to, you know, right. And
cool.
they're basically
perfect.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We should. Well, Hunter Newby. Well, I'll
yeah.
tell you about it.
AT&T is building one.
No, but this is that is completely. You know, you just are leasing the fiber.
Yeah, we've just leased dark fiber, basically.
Right. That's
what we'd
like
to do.
That company's doing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How are you funding your project?
Donations.
Yeah, so in October there was a conference that was organized by Douglas Rushkoff of the New School of
Contact.
So we won a prize there, an innovation prize for our tower, which we had just finished and we brought. So that kind of gave us the seed capital to get rolling, and we've been trying to leverage that into some more donations. But the fact of the matter is, we just need a little seed capital. We view ourselves as a startup and one that really ought to be able to grow with a little bit of seed capital for initial capital expenditures. But the model is
in Detroit.
Yeah.
So
have you applied for public money or what?
Well, recently the Obama administration allocated a large grant for community wireless solutions to Detroit Digital Justice Coalition and a couple other organizations.
And they,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also sent, they also recently gave money for the light rail project, which I feel like we can find our place in.
Our synergy.
Because, well, for a lot of reasons.
Conduit by the railroad tracks?
Possibly, right. Because that was...
That's what Allied Fiber is doing.
Yeah.
They cut a deal with the name of the railroad evades me right at the moment, but with a major railroad that had put the conduit down there but wasn't really able to, you know, do anything with it. So they leased it to Allied Fiber. They were just putting the cable through, and that's a lot of... And basically, it's one... landlord that they're dealing with for this, and so therefore it was pretty straightforward to.
As the light rail project grows, I think we would try to get involved with that, because I was involved with that project, advocacy for that project before it came. So I think our contacts and that network would prove beneficial.
There are two things that I'll add. The one is we're still waiting on approval for our tax exempt status, so we are actually incorporated as a nonprofit.
Does licensing that bandwidth cost money?
So licensing $3,650 does, but it's what's great about it is it's like $220, I think, for a nationwide license for as many base stations as you want.
Can an individual do that, or do you have to be a corporation?
An individual can do that.
Right.
An individual can operate 3650 gear.
Right.
The only restriction on it is there are three separate exclusion zones near satellite ground stations where you can't. It's like a 100-kilometer exclusion zone. But outside, and you can even get exemptions in those zones. But inside those zones, you need a specific exemption. The other thing I'll add is that we have a revenue model and. It's not a profit model because the aim of our enterprise isn't profit, but we do have a revenue model that'll allow us to grow. So I want to credit here. I want to give credit to two entities, which are FabFi, which is this community network enterprise that has networks in Afghanistan,
Kenya.
And then I also want to give credit to Bruff Turner and NetBlazer, who are building a co-op in Boston that's really exciting. But both of those initiatives use different names for the same model. Bruff calls it freemium, and FabFi calls it free fee. So the way that works is you can provide a megabit. So let's say you're getting a gigabit pipe. You can provide a megabit of connectivity to anyone for free. as long as you've got a few customers that are willing to pay 50, 75, 100 bucks a month for 50 megabits. So you're talking about a small or medium business here that maybe doesn't even use it as their primary internet service provider, but uses it as a second failover WAN link for their enterprise network. And that's a viable business model where somebody will pay 75 bucks for 50 megabits that there's no service level agreement. We're not saying we're going to give you five nines. We're saying we'll give you two nines because 99%. Who doesn't love it? But that model, I think, is a very viable one, and it's one that will allow us. But the other thing that we're working on concertedly now and over the next few months before we really roll out is what we call sort of the operator's compact, the legal framework for participating, because that is part and parcel. And there's the PICO peering agreement from maybe 10 years ago now was a start in this direction.
So what is that again, the PICO?
So the PICO peering agreement was is a document that was drafted by early pioneers in the community wireless game that was supposed to sort of set a framework for how community networks could grow and could grow to scale. And it didn't quite work. And there are a few reasons. I won't get into them. But what we'd like to see is a system that treats any profit, and the term profit doesn't really make sense here, but revenue in excess of operating costs should be treated as investment. It should be treated as the people that paid that profit investing in ownership, true stakeholdership in the network. So the PICO peering agreement doesn't allow for that, and we'd like to come up with an operating framework that does. So any profit that's being made and that's not being used to subsidize free access for everybody, and we have reason to believe that there will even be revenue in excess of the amount it takes to give free access to people, that revenue needs to be funneled back into the system, not as this is how we grow so that we can make more money for ourselves, you know, more profit, but this is the people that paid this money and the people that are participating but didn't pay the money. That gives each of them shares in the enterprise.
Yeah.
So that's a different model.
And the other aspect of the model, like the profit that we do have, there's no profit to us, it's only to the organization. So the profit to the organization for development, I think, will make our ultimate model, our ultimate appeal, even more practical and more appealing.
You don't have your volunteers now, right? Or
that's correct.
Right, so but you're looking to, obviously you'll need paid staff, and presumably, when you talk about basically a nonprofit model, you'll want to incentivize your most gifted employees, right, giving them a pay raise or something.
Throw that all into operational expenses. Yeah. So there are. You can't run a network without expenses,
right,
but we think we can do it with a far better ratio.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
The ultimate product is the unhierarchical network model, the horizontal communication. So I think that people are just, I think that's going to be a very attractive option 2 years down the line when we have, you know, improved our model.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add, I don't mean to go on forever, but our aim is not to be an ISP.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
We're sort of doing that reluctantly. And we imagine we might have to do it a couple times, a few times in different places. But our hope is that what we're trying to do is lead by example and say, this is a new model for building access networks. Communities should come together and do this for themselves. We have no intention of going city to city and building these types of networks. We do have every expectation that enterprising individuals and enterprising communities in different places will adopt the model. And at that point, we see a potential role for ourselves in helping those operators to interconnect and basically organizing that labor, so to speak, so that it can have an impact on the global bit moving game.
Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, let's wind it up with maybe want to reiterate it. What's the grand goal of, or describe the mission one more time of the Free Network Foundation briefly?
So
I'm sorry, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but
the goal is a network of networks that is owned and operated by humanity itself, mm-hmm. rather than by for-profit operators.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation, and I think that's going to be a real valuable resource for people beyond just knowing a little bit about, you know, the foundation, but also to having a much better understanding of some of the issues here in terms of different ways to provide network access to the world.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.